Hello and welcome to another edition of The More Show, which is sponsored by the UFO Matrix magazine. On today's show, I'll be joined with two famous science fiction actors, who have both appeared in numerous films, but are best known for their iconic appearances in the Star Wars films. They are Kenny Baker, aka R2-D2, and David Prowse, best known for his role as Darth Vader. But my first guest is actor-entertainer Kenny Baker. Now, Kenny, who stands at 3 foot, 8 inches tall, started his performing career in the 1950s, at the age of 16, joining the Burton Leicester Midgets. This was his first taste of show business, which led him to 9 years of touring the UK, doing pantos and various other acting jobs. Kenny also formed a successful comedy act called the Minitones, alongside entertainer and good friend Jack Purvis. But in 1977, George Lucas hired him to be the man inside R2-D2 in Star Wars Episode IV, A New Hope, eventually appearing in all 6 of the theatrical Star Wars films. His other movie credits, to name a few, include The Elephant Man, Time Bandits, and Jim Henderson's Labyrinth. Kenny Baker, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
We're going to talk about your new book from Tiny Acorns. Let's start from the beginning here, Kenny. Let's start from, tell me about your parents and what they used to do and how that influenced you to become a performer.
My father was a draftsman and a bass player. And he could make furniture and he was a general, you know, could do anything really. Built a caravan with his brother and he painted oil paintings. You know, he was an all-round artist, really.
Yeah, but was it this artistic side of your father that got you into wanting to perform, you know, wanting to act?
No, not really. I mean, my parents divorced when I was about 7, so I went into a boarding school in Sevenoaks in Kent.
Okay, so you're at boarding school, your mother and father have separated. What happens after boarding school? Do you go back to live with your mother or your father? Has your mother remarried, or what happens?
No, while I was at boarding school, my mother went to America with a GI at the end of the war. In 1946 or 7, she went there, and I was in Kent. And then when I left, then my father died. We were going to go to Australia. We were going to emigrate. He remarried a dancer from Blackpool or Manchester. And her mother had a hotel in Hastings. So she was down there with my little sister at the time, called Carol. And I left school in Sevenoaks in Kent, which is not far from Hastings. I went down there, but she couldn't look after me because she was looking after mother and the hotel and Carol. So I was in foster care for a while. In Silver Hill, just up the hill from St. Leonard's in Hastings. I met a little lady in the street one day, she said, "Oh, hello, who are you?" And I was along with Kenny Baker, and she said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm going to come and see the show tonight at the Regal." It was the Leicester's Midgets, about 20 midgets and dwarfs. And I just thought I'd come and see the show. She said, "Oh, good." And then he said, "Well, come round afterwards and meet me. But are you working?" And I said, "No, I just left school." "So what are you going to do?" I said, "I haven't got a clue, to be honest. And, you know, I wanted to be a commercial artist like my dad was, but I didn't have the talent really. I wasn't, you know, that clever really. I wasn't an instrumental guy. I wasn't a singer. I wasn't a dancer. You know, I didn't really know what to do. And I went back round stage, and he said, "Yeah, you know, I'll take you. We'll find you something to do." And he said, "We'll start in January at the Metropolitan Theatre in Edgware Road, London." This is about September, I think, something like that. And I thought, "Okay, then." So he said, £5 a week on tour. You know, even nowadays you can't get a meal for £5. And I was on tour for the whole week on a fiver. Went with the show for about 3 years. And then TV came in and that killed the theatres, really.
Now, Kenny, when you was with the Leicester Midgets, this was around the time that you met Stan Laurel and Oliver Hardy. What were they like?
Yeah, I met them in Southend, yeah. Well, you know, they're just two comedians who came stage at the, I think it was the Odeon Cinema. And we were in Southend at another one, the Regal, I think we were at, for the week. And they came on a Saturday morning with the kids, you know, children's shows on Saturday morning with cartoons and a newsreel. And then they showed a Laurel and Hardy film, and then at the end of the film they came on stage. The kids couldn't believe it, you know. And we were in the audience, most of the little guys I was in the show. And we went backstage to see him, that was all. And signed a photograph for me. And that was it, really. Great, nice people. They were, you know, pros, aren't they?
Yeah, of course they were. And do you still have the photograph that they signed for you?
Yeah, oh yeah, of course, yeah.
Now, after you left the Burton Midgets in Leicester, you joined, eventually, the Billy Smart Circus, and from that landed your first film role. Did you get to star alongside Donald Pleasance in that film role? And what was the film called?
Donald Pleasance. I don't remember seeing him. I was in the Circus of Horrors. Yeah, he was probably in it, because it was the kind of film he'd be in. The Circus of Horrors, it was called. And it was filmed, the bit I did, it was filmed at the Clapham Common in South London, where the Smart Circus used to be on there for about a month, just before Christmas. And that's where I did that film. It was all right, but I only had a small part. I was a clown, and I was on the rope of the aerialist, and I was a ringmaster, that's right, dressed as a ringmaster with a top hat and a red coat. And I rode a Shetland pony in the parade and in the finale, a black Shetland pony. And that was about it, really. It was a job for me. And I lived in Clapham at the time, luckily, in a flat for £3 a week, in a flat in Grove, just near Clapham tube station. Then from there, I got into the Michael Sullivan, who was Shirley Bassey's manager, booked me for an ice show at Norwich. And I went and did the ice show at Norwich. He said, "Can you skate?" I said, "Well, I can roller skate." So he said, "Well, go down to Streatham and learn to ice skate if you can. Otherwise, I should be able to if I can roller skate." And that's what I did. So I went to Norwich for about 6 weeks, I think it was, at the Hippodrome. I don't think it's there anymore. Theatre Royal is a big one. They're the nicer theatre. It's still there, that one is. And then I did that one. I met all the ice skating people, and they said, "Well, you want to go to Blackpool, really? You'll have 20 weeks in the middle of the summer. All over 20 weeks, a good long season." So I got into the ice show at Blackpool in 1954, that was. That's just 1953 was a bad year for theatres, with the TV coming out. And that was the year the Queen was crowned as the Queen, in 1953. Anyway, I got with the ice show, and then I thought, well, what am I going to do in the winter, you know? So I had my stepmother's connections around Manchester and stayed there for a while. And then I got a job at the Ritz in Whitworth Street, Mecca Ballroom. And then I've got a job with pantomime with Emil Littler, then in Babes in the Wood. So I've got this trio going. I had the pantomime every year for 6 years in Babes in the Wood. Then I had the summer season at Blackpool for 6 years in a different show every year at the Pleasure Beach. And then in between these two shows, I did the Ritz at Whitworth Street. Just as a host, really. I opened the door and I sold raffle tickets and played harmonica with the band, you know, did a few numbers on the harmonica with them. And it was a good trio of show, you know, did it for 6 years.
Okay, well, let's just take this forward to the early part of the 1960s. And this is the time where you got a part in Snow White and where you met your long-term friend, Jack Purvis, who played a considerable role in your life, would you say, Kenny?
Well, he saw the advert in the Sunday Express or some regular paper in London and wanted for ice show, you know, little guys who could skate Because there weren't many around, you know, really. And he said he could skate. He used to go a few skating trips to Haringey, which is his nearest ice rink, I think. Anyway, we met at the wardrobe just off Piccadilly. London something or other. And the office was Tom Arnold and Gordon Blackie with the agent. And he said, well, you know, we'll have you as Dopey and Jack, who was my partner there, he was eventually. Jack's playing Bashful. And they had all the little guys lined up, more or less. And we went into that was in 1960. Snow White on Ice. And we toured with that for quite a while. And then they kept stopping these ice shows. They just, like, season somewhere, and then they'd stop. And then they'd do a summer show somewhere, and that would stop, of course. And they might send a tour, or they might send a show to... we went to Dublin with the ice shows. Oh, they did summer season at Ramsgate. Summer season at Morecambe, summer season at Paignton, summer season in Brighton.
Yeah.
Plus the winter seasons, you know, as well. So that was a lucky break, getting with the ice shows. And in between all these breaks, Jack and I formed a double act called the Minitones. We got doing quite well, you know. With Huey Green's Opportunity Knocks. And nearly won that a few times. We did it two or three times. We nearly won it a few times, but they were looking for recording material, really, on those acts, mainly, like they do now with the X Factor. They're looking for recording people, really.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, not acrobats or magicians or anything like that. They want singers, don't they?
That's right.
So they can make more money out of them, see. So anyway, we got the act going. We went to Germany first because we thought if we're a bad act, nobody will know about it in Germany. or over here. So we started off in Germany, really. And then we got the working men's clubs all over the place. And we were doing pretty well, you know. We were one of the top acts in the London area at the time. And unusual acts, of course, a musical. You know, I played harmonica and vibraphone. And Jack played his trumpet. And he did most of the talking. It was good comedy act. It worked quite well. I was a straight man, and he was a comic. But in some ways, I was a comic. And I was doing facial expressions while he was doing his verbal stuff, you know. And it worked. Whatever.
It worked. It worked very well.
Yeah. It worked quite well. It was like Morecambe and Wise, you know. They were both comics in a way, really. But Eric was the comic and Ernie was the straight man. But we played instruments, they didn't do that. They were purely talkers. And they weren't singers either. We sang a few times. We weren't singers either, but we got away with it.
Yeah, you got away with it, but you made it very successful.
Well, we enjoyed it. It was a good act, so we really enjoyed it. And then we got in with Pontins, and then we got in with Warners, and one or two Butlins. And then pantomimes, you know, we play in Snow White and Seven Dwarfs on ice as well as on stage with Linda Lusardi. We did about 6 years with Linda. So we got on really well with Linda. She's a nice girl.
Now, was it not true that you met your wife through a letter that she sent you after she saw a TV appearance of yourself? And she was intrigued by the interview that took place after. And I believe he was on the Dave Allen show.
Oh, that's right, yeah, because I did a few shows with
Dave
Allen.
That's right.
An Irish comedian. And I have sketches all over the place, you know. We did Dave Allen. Then I did a few spots on my own with whoever, you know, with Dick Emery and Tommy Cooper and... stacks of people, really, lots of whatever was on. I was usually on it, and sometimes Jack was with me as well. And I don't know where I was, but a letter got to me via Dave Allen from a girl in Preston called Eileen, and she wanted to know how to cope with a dwarf or a midget, because a neighbour of theirs had a baby boy, and she didn't know how to cope. cope with a boy, you know. And she wanted to know what the situation was with a boy, see. So I said, well, it did. I mean, it doesn't make any difference, really. You're just a baby, but boy or a girl. There's no difference to anybody else. You just happen to be a bit smaller than everybody else. You know, you can be physically a little bit... I'm a bit physically not quite as I could be, because I've got short arms and short fingers, as well as quite short legs. So that doesn't help at the times, especially now I'm getting older. But anyway, so that's how I got into it, you see, and I was working at the Winter Gardens at Morecambe in Snow White on Ice. And I thought, well, Preston's not far away, so I gave her a ring, and we met in the August, I think, my birthday time. And I took her to the casino in Blackpool, and we went to the Water Rats. You had a yearly party at Blackpool with all the artists that were in Blackpool at the time. Like, there were 14 live shows in Blackpool, would you believe? With circus, you know, ice shows, not Three Piers, Winter Gardens, the Opera House. Anyway, well, there were 14 altogether. And so I saw Eileen at the party at the casino, and we got engaged. And she said, well, what are we going to do? What are you doing at Christmas? I said, well, we're going down to Paignton in Devon, near Torquay, with Snow White on ice again, you know, on a stage. They used to carry a tank of, they could fit up the ice show on a tank. So, and I said, well, all I could do is get a caravan, and we can go take the caravan out of Paignton, which is what we did. But so we got married in the, excuse me, in December, and the next, on the Friday, I think it was, or the Saturday, and on the Sunday we travelled down to Birmingham, where I came from, and stayed in the hotel in Hurst Street, near the Hippodrome in Birmingham, and then we stayed there with, Donald Pierce was in there at the time.
Incredible.
Yeah, and said, hello, where's your wife? I said, she's upstairs. So he said, well, get her down, we'll have another glass of champagne, and or another bottle of champagne. And that, you know, we then had to travel all the way down to Paignton the next day with a caravan, towing a caravan. And that's how I got married and started off my life with Eileen.
Okay. So you could say that 1969 was a very special year for you then, basically.
Oh, it was a good year, 1969. That was when the Concorde first flew, and the men on the moon, they took off for the moon in 69, because I was in Morecambe at the time, and when they landed on the moon, and then the Concorde flew that time. I don't quite know exactly when that took off, but it all happened, you know. It was a good year for me, that was 69.
Good.
The 60s were the best time, actually, I think, for everybody, because all the clubs and all the theatres were going, and most of the theatres, the big theatres anyway. The West End was buzzing like crazy, you know, and the Beatles were, and the Stones, and all the, you know, top, the Searchers, and all kinds of good acts were running around, you know, doing big shows at big... And then they brought these clubs out with a restaurant type, where you could sit down and have a meal and watch a show at the same time. And they were packed out, coaches, from all over the place, and to see Dave Allen at Watford, and the big club, Bailey Clubs, they started off in Sunderland and gradually worked their way south, and they got as far as Watford, Bailey Clubs, you know, very well run. And Blazers at Windsor was another good club. And, this is never going to end, you know. But all these things do, they don't seem to last all that long.
Well, that's it, Kenny. The word is change. Everything changes.
Change so quickly. I can't stand all this screaming and shouting and at these TV shows like X Factor. You know, I just can't stand it. It doesn't make any sense to me. They have acts on. They can't possibly hear what they're singing or what they're talking about because they're too busy screaming. I mean, it's crazy. I just turn it off. I can't be bothered to watch it. And then they've got judges, a panel of judges. And then they say, well, it's up to the audience, you know, the man in the street, to judge. And they haven't got a clue. You know, they haven't got a clue, most of them anyway. And I think, well, you know, they don't ax people on that who should never, ever have started in the first place, you know. And yet they vote for them because they go, oh, what a shame, you know. And they get the sympathy vote.
Yeah, you've got some good points there, Kenny. You know, the X Factor's not my cup of tea, but, you know, I suppose it is just light entertainment. So, okay, well, let's just skip forward to 1971. And I believe, was that the year that your first son, Kevin, was born?
Well, no, we had Chris first, that's right. Chris was the oldest, and then Kevin.
Now, at the time when you had your kids, you know, you're a full-time dad, you know, you're an actor, entertainer, but also... Your wife wasn't very well at that time, neither was she.
Well, she had epilepsy, you see. I didn't know that until I'd married her, really. And she told me, but I'd seen a mild attack, and it's a bit scary, you know, frightening, really. But you just get used to them. There's nothing you can do about it.
No, you've got to live with it and support them, that's right.
Yeah, she was getting worse and worse, and gradually worried about it, you know. And it was a bit grim for her, really. And I couldn't leave her alone, really. I couldn't just take off if she wasn't well, you know, if she was being ill with epilepsy. So I thought, well, I'd better move out of Bushey in Hertfordshire and move up here, which is what I did, you see. And then I went down south for any job that came up and just had to put up with it, you see. And then Jack, my partner, said, well, I think that's the end of our double act because you're too far away. I mean, he lived in Bushey as well. We both lived nearby each other. By design, so that we could travel in each other's cars, you know, whichever. And he said, that's the end of the double act, really, isn't it? I said, well, not really. I mean, we can still do summer season, and we can still do Christmas pantomime seasons. And maybe go on our own ways in between. Which we did, really, for about, well, not long. And then Jack had an accident with his car.
Well, before we go there, let's just go to the year 1976, where you receive a call from your agent of then, Johnny Laycock, who informed you that he had heard a whisper from the owner of a club where you worked at, that some American people were in town looking for a small person to fit inside a robot.
Oh, that was in the 1970s. Well, Jack and I were working around in the London area all the time, basically. Southeast, anyway, of London, England. So, you know, anywhere sort of draw a line across from King's Lynn to Birmingham and to Wales, and we'd work south of that line, really. And we can drive out, do a show, and drive home again. We were in the area in London, and our agent was just down the road in Bushey as well. And he got word of it from another agent, friend of his, to say that there was a guy called Lucas in town looking for somebody small to be in the robot. So they sent me down, or my agent did. And I said, well, what about Jack? He said, well, there'll probably be parts in the film for Jack as well. So I went down there and then walked in the room, and they said, oh, yeah, you'll do, because I was the right height, really. And that was all it amounted to.
Right.
And I said, yeah, you'll do. And I didn't want to do it because I was doing we were doing Opportunity Knox for Huey Green at the time. And I didn't really want to be stuck in a robot, but I thought, well, oh, well, might as well. I can do the filming in the daytime and the cabaret in the London area at night, you know, as well as the TV bits. So, you know, it worked out very well, really.
So
that's
you,
what I did.
So you wasn't originally going to take the part of R2-D2 only because Jack wasn't going to have a part in it himself, is that right?
Yeah, well, yeah, I said to Lucas and whoever was around at the time, what about Jack, you know? And they thought, oh, don't worry, there's plenty of little parts we can give Jack, which is what they did.
Can I ask you, Kenny, when you took the part to take R2-D2, did you go with your gut feeling?
Well, they all knew me down the south, you see. Most of the people, agents and people knew me. And I'd done other, you know, like the Circus of Horrors and bits of TV bits. And then, everybody knew me, so I just walked into the part.
So, what was it like then, Kenny, being inside the R2-D2 robot?
Well, it wasn't very comfortable, really, at first. It was sharp edges here and there, and nails and screws and things sticking out inside, which I had to get sorted out. And cables everywhere, wiring everywhere with the electric lights on, and a battery inside making a noise that, you know, know, for the electric lights. And a battery was between my legs, and it wasn't very comfortable. It was noisy. And it was heavy, weighed about 80 pounds. So it wasn't very comfortable, but I put up with it, you know. I thought it's better than... I don't want to lose the part, really.
No, that's right. And, you know, was it good money for the time?
No, not good, really. I said, well, if you can give me the same money as I'm getting in the cabaret, and in case I don't get to do any more cabaret, with filming all day, you know, you don't feel much like going out to work again in the evening as well. But that's what we did. That's what I did anyway. We didn't work every night in cabaret. We worked like Wednesdays, Fridays and Saturdays.
And what was it like to work with George Lucas?
Oh, he's great. Nice bloke, George. Yeah. He knows what he's doing. He's got his head screwed on. He knows what he wants. And he's a good director. He knows exactly what he wants. So when he tells you to do something, you know it'll be right, you know. And that was all it was. He was an easy guy to get on with.
And was you aware at the time of how much Star Wars would change your life?
No, nobody knows, do they? They guess they're going to hope they're going to be good. I think George must have done, you know. And Alec Guinness was in it, and I thought if Alec Guinness is in it, it must be going to be pretty good, otherwise he wouldn't be in it. And he knows more about filming than anybody. At least he knows more than I do what was going to happen. But I didn't. So I never made a fortune, but we did okay, you know. Not complaining, really.
And what was it like to work alongside Sir Alec Guinness?
Well, the actors, you know, they're just people that go into a film and act the part and then go home and then wait for the next one. So, you know, they were usually quite friendly and nice people.
Now, when Star Wars began filming in 1976, I believe it was one of the hottest years on record. So what was that like, being confined inside the R2-D2 machine?
Uncomfortable, really. And hot, most of the time. Because it was always hot. Well, it was in 76, which is a hot summer. But that was one of the hottest years we had. And also, if you get into a studio, a sound stage with no... You know, there's no air getting into the place, so it gets hotter and hotter with all the lights. So that was uncomfortable, eventually. No, it's just one of those things, you've just got to get used to it.
Now, did you not take Mark Hamill and Curry Fisher into London to watch you perform as the Minitones?
Well, we did that. We did our show for a rap party one year. Because we did the show for 3 or 4 years, you know, Star Wars. Lasted from 76 till 82. And there was a break in between, wasn't there? And we did another 3 films, 4, 5, and 6, 90, in the mid-90s, anyway. So, you know, that first lot, it was good. We were, like, younger than we were, and we were doing well with films as well as cabaret. And we were out to Canada and New Zealand and South Africa, without Star Wars, doing other stuff, you see, and so we were having a great time, really.
Yeah.
And we were both married, and Jack had 3 kids, and I had 2, and we had our own houses, and we always had a nice car to get to, you know, so that it was reliable to get us to the gigs. And getting home 2 o'clock in the morning, you don't want a rackety old car. So we were lucky when, you know, we got to the, and then they got to the next trilogy. Which were the, not, there weren't so many actors in it, really, not just the main parts, like Mark Hamill and Carrie and Darth Vader, Jeremy Bullock, and Peter Mayhew and myself, 4 of us. And then there was Anthony Daniels, of course, who was C-3PO. So we were in it, but there weren't really many big stars in the next 3. And the occasional American came in and went out again, you know, of the movies.
Yeah. I mean, you did star alongside Peter Cushing as well. I mean, you know, that guy was a cult figure, you know, in the Dracula series and the Hammer movie studios.
Yeah. That's right, all the buddies. It's good, it's interesting, you know, you can meet these people. And I haven't seen my Harrison Ford, I don't think, since the first 3 films. Because he did very well the Indiana Jones movies, you know, for Lucasfilm. So he's a big star now in America.
But at the time, Kenny, did you know he was going to be such a big movie star?
Well, he did American Graffiti. That's the film he first started with Lucas. And then he went from that to Star Wars. And then he's done lots of big movies since then, hasn't he? He's done very well. I don't know what Mark Hamill's done, really. And Anthony Daniels hasn't done anything, I don't think. Carrie Fisher's always buzzing around. But there's only Dave Prowse, and Peter Mayhew, and Jeremy Bullock, and myself going around all the conventions all over the world.
I heard, Kenny, that Mark Hamill charges about $50,000 for an interview. Is that right?
It's ridiculous, isn't it? I don't know if they've got the nerve to do it. I certainly don't charge that much. I don't think he wants to do it, really. That's why he charges such a lot. You know, it's, well, I don't want to do it, because, you know, he doesn't want to come over here much. So he asks for a lot of money. Sometimes he gets it.
Now, there was a programme on Channel 4 called Bring Back Star Wars. And on that, both yourself and Anthony Daniels, C-3PO, both commented on how difficult it was to work with each other. Was Anthony difficult to work with?
I don't know why he is difficult to everybody. Even the fans, you know, the fan club people. He never speaks to me, never speaks to Jeremy. So I give it up with him. I tried for years and said to him, you know, we should go out together, you and me, as we like seen on the screen together. Said to me, oh, I don't do many of these, and that's it. Closes the book, as it were. So I don't bother anymore with him. You know, I can't be bothered. In fact, you know what? They just brought out a commercial now for Currys.
That's right, I've seen it.
Yes, it's him and me, isn't it?
Yeah, it is you both.
And I didn't know anything about it till about 2 days ago.
Well, it can only keep your profile up, Kenny.
It won't be bad, will it? And it falls down, doesn't it? And the robot falls on its face.
No, it's actually a really good advert, and we'll actually put a link for the advert onto our webpage for you as well. So continuing on with the Star Wars theme, Kenny, how big were the sets?
Well, it took up a whole, like an aeroplane hangar in the studio. Sound stages. And made about 5 or 6 of these. Oh, they were fantastic sets.
And what was it like to have all the cast under one roof?
What was it like? What are you? You're filming, you're making a film, you know. We weren't always in there every day. I mean, if you weren't in a particular scene, and they were going to take one or 2 days to film it, so you had one or 2 days off, you know. You weren't with everybody all the time.
No.
And also, you don't often see the person. Some people will come into a film and say their lines, and go home and you not see them again. You probably have never met them, you know.
Yeah.
Because we did Labyrinth and Willow and...
That's right. We're going to come on to Willow and Labyrinth in a minute. But out of all the Star Wars films, Kenny, that you starred in, what was your favourite Star Wars film?
Oh, I think The Empire Strikes Back is about the best. Well, most of us think the same. They're all good in their own way, you know. Jedi was good with the Ewoks.
What I've heard from the fans is that what let the last three most recent Star Wars films down was the high use of CGI.
Yes. Well, that's of course, I mean, that's what all the actors would think anyway, wouldn't they? Because you're not acting, obviously. It's you know, CGI or whatever you call it, which is not doing the business much good, I don't think, really. But there again, the kids don't know, do they? They like it. You know, the younger generation, they don't recognise an actor. You know, they don't realise that whether it's a good acting or bad acting. You know, it's just a big event, isn't it? A film. For kids.
That's right.
So, you know, they're quite happy with the new ones as well as what we were with the first ones, you know. What the heck, it doesn't matter, as long as everybody's happy.
But to sum up Star Wars, Kenny, I mean, what's it mean to you that you starred in these iconic movies that are going to be there for generations upon generations.
I'm very lucky in that respect, you know. I think, well, it can't go on forever, but it seems to be going on forever, doesn't it? So let's hope it does.
Well, Star Wars 3D gets released in 2012, I believe.
Yes, that's right. 3D. They're going to... I don't know how they're going to do that, but they're going to make them into 3D somehow. But, I mean, there's things like that commercial that's come out this week on TV with for Currys. So there we go. So it's going to start doing things like that. It can't be good for us, as you said before. So I'm just ticking over, really. I'm just doing the occasional show. About 2 a month at the most, at the moment. Which is fine for me. I don't want to go working backside off all over the world, you know. I only want to stay in Europe. Now, I can't fly to America anymore. It's the recycled air on the aeroplanes doesn't do my chest any good. You know, I collapsed on the way back from Chicago a couple of years ago now, and nearly died of pneumonia, so they tell me. I passed out completely. So I'm frightened to go any further than Europe now. The 2-hour flights are enough for me.
You've got to look after yourself.
Yeah, it's not worth getting killed, is it, just to sign a few autographs, you know?
They can come to you.
That's right.
Now, Kenny, tell me about your meeting with the legendary boxer, Muhammad Ali.
Well, Jack and I were doing a charity show in Holloway, and Muhammad Ali was there. Henry Cooper, all the boxers that you could wish for were there, really. I can't remember all the names of them now. I knew all the boxers of the 60s and 70s.
Incredible.
And Muhammad Ali was there, and I said to him, "This is my wife, Eileen." And he looked down and he said, "Oh, she's really pretty." And then he looked at her and he said, "Couldn't you have done better than that?"
Okay. So
yeah, I thought I better not hit him. Yeah, he's a good, nice fellow he was. He was very, very witty, wasn't he? He did the Parkinson's show a few times, and he was very witty, really.
Now, one of your iconic films that you starred in was Time Bandits, which is also one of my favourite films. So tell me about your experience on that film.
Well, that was a good film. You know, I enjoyed that more than most of the Star Wars films, really. It was good fun to make. You know, and there were six of us in that, and all the little fellas got on well with each other. And there was nobody, anybody that we didn't get on with. And it was just a good film. Michael Palin and there were actors and actresses. Everybody was good. And it's the only film, apart from Star Wars, that the Americans know me from. You know, they all know me from Time Bandits in America, because it was very popular over there. They're very happy with Monty Python type stuff in America. And the only people really have done well over there was Benny Hill, And Time Bandits, you know, which were very English at the time, and it's strange, isn't it?
But it's a great script. It's a great film.
Yeah, it was a good film.
So, who were some of the more major actors that you met while filming Time Bandits?
Well, I mean, the people in the film.
Well, there was Sean Connery, wasn't there?
Sean Connery was only one scene. Well, the one scene that we were with him, when he was the king, he played a king at one time. Then he played a fireman at the end of the film, which I wasn't in on that scene. And he was a king in Morocco, on horseback. I didn't go to Morocco, I didn't see him there. You know, there were scenes in these things, you don't meet everybody all the time, you know. But all of them were good, you know, the American was good. There was Michael Palin, of course, and... I've forgotten the name now. I can't remember the American woman. Hellman. Somebody Hellman. All good actresses.
Now, another pioneering film producer that you worked with was Jim Henson. Could you just tell us what it was like to work with Jim?
Well, Jim Henson, he was a guy that did all the Muppets and didn't he? All the Muppet stuff. And We were always stuck inside costumes. So you didn't always get a chance to meet people because you were stuck inside these costumes. You couldn't talk. And you were lucky if you could see where you were going about, never mind talking to people. And, they always kept putting little people in little costumes, little animals or something. So I wasn't very comfortable. That would get, that was that labyrinth, that one, wasn't it? And we were in Willow as well. There were a lot of people in Willow. And we weren't inside a costume there. Willow was quite a good film. Good for Warwick Davis. He went out to New Zealand with that. Jack and I were in it, and we were asked if we would go as well to New Zealand, but we were doing summer show in this country at the time. For Warners, I think it was.
And you enjoyed filming Willow?
Willow, yeah, that good film, yeah, it's okay.
And now, at this time, was it not your stage partner, Jack Purvis, your stage partner of the Minitones, that had an awful, tragic accident? And what could you tell us what happened?
Yeah, 91 he did. He had the accident. Yeah, the car went back in his driveway, and he tried to stop it physically, and he went back with the car and went through the gatepost, wrought iron gates, and broke his neck, and landed on the pavement, and the car crossed the street. Good job nobody was around at the time. It would have been a worse accident than it was. But Jack was on the pavement, and he didn't know it, but he couldn't feel his feet and everything. And a woman said, "And you're right." He said, "Well, don't move me, because I told you I can move my back or anything." So anyway, she phoned the ambulance from his house, and paramedics came, and that was the end of that. That was the end of the show, really, for me and Jack. He was completely paralysed.
So that was the end of the Minitones, then?
The end of the Minitones, yeah. Terrible. It was really worse. You wouldn't wish that on your worst enemy, because, he was completely paralysed from the neck downwards. Couldn't do anything at all. Couldn't scratch his nose. Couldn't do anything.
Did it make you appreciate life more when that happened?
Oh, I should say so, yeah. You begin to think how lucky you are, you know. If you've got any... I'm a bit fed up with myself now at the moment, because I've got... My wife died. Jack's dead now. He lasted 6 years, as he was. It was like a living death for him anyway, you know, really. So all he could do is sit in a chair and watch TV. Couldn't even talk properly, because he had a breathing machine. It was terrible. Anyway, he lasted about 6 years, from 91 to 96, when he died. And I was with Eileen, you know, my wife, and she died in 93, about 2 years after Jack's accident. So certainly I've got, you know, my mum and dad had died, and I left school, and my mum and dad had died. It wasn't all sort of fairy lights and show business and all that jazz. It was pretty grim around at some time.
So when Jack passed away then, Kenny, did you try to keep the Minitones act going?
I had to struggle along on my own after that. Got a solo act, went out to Spain, went to Benidorm and the Canaries. And I was doing okay, but I wasn't really as good as Jack and me as a double act. So the accident, not an accident, my accident, no, when I passed out from Chicago, I've been a bit fed up at times, you know. I'm stuck here on my own. I didn't have a dog, because I thought, well, I can't walk about with a dog very easily now myself, you know. I haven't got the energy that I used to have.
Well, look, Kenny, I appreciate the time you've given us for this interview, and just to sort of summarise this, is there any message you'd like to give to your fans?
Just to say big thank you to all the fans that show up at these functions, conventions and what have you. And I can't believe my luck, really. I'm still going to these places and signing autographs and whatever. It's great, you know. What more can I say? Hopefully it'll go on for as long as I'm here, and probably longer. Probably go on for a few more years yet. You never know. Just bring this out in 3D. They'll buy all the things again, won't they, in 3D? So that should cause another round of autograph signings with a bit of luck.
And your new book, The Kenny Baker Story, is available from your website, kennybaker.co.uk.
Yeah.
And I believe that you offer a autographed book as well.
Yeah, there's a guy called Ken Mills. He's looking after my website for me. He's taking all the books, orders. It's on the internet.
Well, Kenny Baker, all I can say is it's been a pleasure to have you on. You're an absolute legend.
Thank you very much.
Well, that was absolutely lovely to be joined with Kenny Baker there. And like he said, if you want to find out more information on Kenny Baker, just go to kennybaker.co.uk or visit my site, themoreshow.co.uk, and look up Kenny Baker under past guests, and the links for all his books will be there. Well, we're about to be joined by our next guest now, which is David Prowse. Now, David was born in Bristol in July 1935, and as a teenager, he became interested in bodybuilding and set his sights on becoming Mr. Universe, but went on to become a competitive weightlifter, eventually becoming British heavyweight weightlifting champion and representing his country in the World Weightlifting Championships. His physique allowed him to enter into the world of show business, where he has appeared in numerous TV and film roles over the years, including Hammer, The Horror of Frankenstein, and A Clockwork Orange. He is also well known for playing the Green Cross Codeman in the successful Road Safety Campaign. But he's best known for his role as Darth Vader in 1977 Star Wars that most people will know him for. David Prowse, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, David, let's start from the beginning here with yourself. Let's start when you were 13. Now, at 13, you were registered as a crippled child. Is that right?
That's right. I went into hospital. My left knee started swelling up because I was actually a very, very fast schoolboy athlete. And I was running all the time, like I was training. Belonged to one of the big athletic clubs. I used to train actually with Mary Rand years ago. You know, our 800. I think she was 800
meter
runner. And we belonged to the same athletic club. And my knee started to swell up, and the surgeons, you know, sort of looked at it, the doctor looked at it, didn't know what it was. Then the surgeon looked at it and said, "Well, I think you ought to come in for exploratory tests." And so he raced me into hospital, and thinking I had tuberculosis of the knee. And in fact, what it was through all the training that I was doing, my joints were reacting to my training, and all I needed was rest. But they kept me in hospital for a year, and then put me in a leg iron. I was 5'9" when I went into hospital. I was 6'3" when I came out, and I went up to 6'5" by the time I came out of the leg iron at 15 and a half. And then after that, I then, obviously, my athletic career had gone. And they said, "Well, do some exercises and start to get your leg back stronger." And I started swimming, which I didn't like. And the next thing I did was I bought myself a bodybuilding magazine. And from there on, all I ever wanted to be was Mr. Universe. And that was really the start of everything. January 1951.
Well, tell me about your time, though, as a bodybuilder and as a heavyweight weightlifting champion.
Well, I trained for 9 years to go from, I was 6'5" and weighed about 11 stone. And I went to, nine years later, I got invited to enter the Mr. Universe contest, and I was 6'7", and I weighed about 17 and a half stone, like, you know, so it was, quite a transition. And also, as I said, going from, you know, from a sort of being registered as a crippled child to being a sort of Mr. Universe contestant. But when I was in the Universe contest, at the end of the competition, the chief of the judges came out to me and he said, "Look, I'm ever so sorry," he said, "but you'll never ever win the Mr. Universe." And I said, "Well, why not? And, you know, what's the problem? You know, I'm the biggest competitor you've ever had, and obviously I can get a lot bigger." And he said, "Well, no, it's nothing to do with your physique." He said, "You've got ugly feet." And I said, I can't train my feet." He said, "Well, I'm sorry." He said, "You've got large toe joints and hammer toes and things like this." And he said, "If it comes to a decision between two physiques of equal standard, the judges will nitpick, and unfortunately, you'll get dropped." And so I thought, well, if that's what bodybuilding is all about, let's chuck it in and do something else. So yeah. I changed over then to competitive weightlifting, as I was getting quite strong, and I held quite a few British weightlifting records at the time, and changed over to what we call Olympic weightlifting. And in 1961, I got third place in the British Heavyweight Championships. In 62, I won it and became British heavyweight weightlifting champion. And I did the World Championships in Budapest. And I also did the Empire and Commonwealth Games in Perth. And in 63, I won it again. 64, I won it again. And in 64, I was training for the Olympic Games in Tokyo and had been selected for the team and set up a qualifying total and all these sorts of things. And at the last minute, the Weightlifting Association turned around and said, well, look, you know, ever so sorry, but we haven't got enough money to send a heavyweight to Tokyo, so you won't be going. So I thought, well, this is another disappointment, like, you know, so I'll change tack again and, just pack up competing and turn professional, see what happens. And then almost like the first thing that happened was I got offered a job up in London working for an American weightlifting company. And I came up to London and was sales manager for this particular company for a couple of years. And at the same time, I got my very first offer of a job in show business, which is working for a stunt agency called Tough Guys. And my very first job was a play at the Mermaid Theatre called Don't Let Summer Come, which was directed by Bernard Miles. And all I had to do was pick an actor up off of a bed very, very slowly to make it look as though he was levitating.
Yeah.
And by all accounts, they'd auditioned lots of actors for this role, and nobody could pick Kenneth Griffith. It was a little Welsh actor, Kenneth Griffith. Couldn't pick him up off the bed or pick him out as they wanted, because they wanted him to look as though he was just sort of levitating up into the air. And I said, well, look, you know, if you take this part on, nobody will ever know that you've done it. He said, so you're not going to get discovered. He said, you're going to be in a black shirt, black gloves, black socks. The entire stage will be blacked out, apart from the light, which will be shining on Kenneth Griffith. And so, as I said, you're not going to be discovered. And as I said, and also because you come into it late, we won't even have time to get your name in the program. So he said, if you're still interested, you know, we'd like to have you. So that's what I did.
And what age were you at that point?
Oh, God, 27. Okay. I was British champion.
And just going back to the other question, I mean, with regards to bodybuilding and the scene in the UK right now, I mean, there's so many young people or younger generation that are either taking, you know, steroids or think they're taking it.
That's the worst thing that ever happened in the bodybuilding world. Well, in sports in general, it's not only bodybuilding, but I mean, bodybuilding and weightlifting are two of the biggest culprits. But it's the worst thing that ever happened in the drug situation in sports. I mean, as I said, it's not only steroids, but nowadays it's everything else which they have to take to develop these enormous physiques and this absolute, you know, paper thin skin and muscular definition and all this sort of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I personally would hate to be a competitive bodybuilder these days. I would hate it.
So what then got you into acting, would you say? What was the push to get into acting?
Well, I never wanted to be an actor. I just got this offer out of the blue. I was sales manager for this weightlifting company, and I just happened to call into a gymnasium up in London called Mayfair Gymnasium. And they had this stunt agency attached to it. And they said, look, you know, if ever there was any work in show business, would you be interested? And I said, well, you know, not really, because I'm not an actor. I've never been an actor. And they said, well, don't worry about that. We'll cross that hurdle when we come to it. And as I said, within like 2 weeks, I got a call from the agency saying, get rent to the Mermaid Theatre. They're looking for somebody like you. And that basically was the start of it.
Yeah.
I went to the Mermaid, got the job. And then the next thing I know, the agency started putting me up for things like, doing sort of heavy parts, you know, playing, because I was 6'7", you see, and at that time weighing about 18, 19 stones, so the difference with me was that I was reasonably good looking, as it were. You know, or in the past, if you wanted somebody big and heavy, you had to have an ex-wrestler or an ex-boxer, you know, with their cauliflower ears and broken noses and things like this. You know, they look tough. Whereas I look reasonably well, you know, because I had all my facial features.
Yeah.
And as I said, then I started getting all these offers of different roles. And then, of course, my first film came along, which was the original Casino Royale. And the first part I had offered in the film was working opposite Peter Sellers and Ursula Andress, and I thought, well, that's a good entrance into a movie.
Exactly.
And then that fell through, but Peter Sellers walked off of the set in the middle of this scene that we were doing, and never came back. So that was the end of that scene. And then they rang me up and said, well, you know, were you that we measured for the Frankenstein outfit? And I said, well, no, it wasn't. And they said, well, we've got this Frankenstein outfit here, and we would you like to come out and see if it fits? And I went up to the studio. It was MGM at the time. And of course, his suit fitted like a glove. And they said, "Well, you're now going to play Frankenstein opposite David Niven." And I thought, "Wow, this is what an entry into the film career." And, I mean, and then of course, while I was working on Casino Royale, I met up with people like Orson Welles, Dahlia Lavi, Barbara Boucher, Peter O'Toole. We had all sorts of name, character actors coming into this film. It was amazing. Yeah.
Now, at the same time as doing this, you then got into the work of the road safety as the Green Cross code man.
Oh, that came much later.
Well, tell me about the work on the road safety.
Well, in 1976, I had two greatest offers ever. One was Star Wars. And at exactly the same time, I went for an audition. My agent got in touch with me, and she said, "Look, she said, Ogilvy, Benson & Mather, which is the big advertising agency, have got the contract from the Department of Transport, or the Central Office of Information, to do a whole series of road safety commercials for children. And it's for the road safety code called the Green Cross Code. And they were looking for a Superman-type character, you know. I went along for I was the only person that went for it, actually. I went there to see them, and they said, "Well, yeah, definitely, you're definitely exactly what we're looking for. Thank you very much. The job's yours." I said, "Well, when do you want to film? Because it looks as though I'm just about to start work on a movie called Star Wars." And they said, "Oh, don't worry about that. Go ahead and accept Star Wars, and we'll get in touch with you, you know, when we need you, because we want to get the commercials done in time for the September, October, sure, November period leading up to Christmas." And this was right at the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
And so off I went. I went off and did Star Wars, of course. But I was on Star Wars for 5 months. And every so often I would get a call from the Department of Transport, and they said, "Well, any idea when you're going to finish on this movie?" And I said, no, not as yet. And then they'd ring me up a month later and say, "What's the situation?" And I would say, "Well, I'm still working on it." And then a bit later on, they call again, and they say, "Well, you know, how much longer are you going to be on this movie for? What's it like?" And I said, "Well, it's a right old load of rubbish, actually." And eventually they turned around and said, it was getting towards September time, and they said, "Well, look, sure, either you get a week off, or we're going to recast." So I went to George Lucas and I said, "Oh, do me a favor, can I have a week off so I can do these Green Cross Code commercials?" He said, "Yeah, all right, we'll reschedule for you." And that's what happened. So I went. I did the Green Cross Code commercials, which came out on the Christmas of 1977. And then, of course, Star Wars didn't come out until 78. And then, of course, as soon as Star Wars came out, the government suddenly found out that I was the big villain and I was killing everybody left, right, and center. And they thought my image as Darth Vader would have a detrimental effect on my image as the Green Cross Code man. And they were going to sack me. But then, of course, when the film did come out, all the kids were absolutely nuts about Star Wars. The fact that I was Darth Vader was the biggest boost that the Green Cross Code ever had.
And that's right.
Because everywhere I went, all the kids knew that the Green Cross Code man was Darth Vader, and it was Darth Vader talking to them about road safety. And the campaign became the most successful road safety campaign that there's ever been.
And you must have saved a lot of lives as well. I mean, you know.
Well, it worked out. I used to go into schools. We used to do three schools a day, 5 days a week, for the entire school, you know, curriculum, like all school periods. And it worked out over the 14, I was 14 years I was involved in it, and over the 14 years, I think I went to 700 different cities throughout the world, because we went to Australia, we went to all over, went to America, New Zealand, went to all over the continent with it, to the British forces bases, you know. So I went to 700 different cities and 2,000 schools, spoke to over 500,000 children, and the net result was, at the end of it all, we'd actually saved something in the region of 250,000 children's lives. The road accident figures in Great Britain went from, well, we're halved. They went down from over 40,000 a year down to less than 20,000.
Well, that's something you can pat yourself on the back
for.
Well,
actually, in the year 2000, I got awarded the MBE from the Queen for services to road safety and charity, which was a great honour.
So, okay, well, let's move it forward a bit there, or backwards maybe in the case, seen as this is the Star Wars era. Mm. Now, you worked with Ridley Scott as well while filming a TV advert.
Years ago, yeah. I worked with him several times. The first TV ad I did with him was for Tonka Toys. And that was the Mighty Tonka, when they were trying to introduce these, you know, steel toys, which they were fantastic toys,
yeah,
into the country. And I did the very first ever Tonka toy commercial. That was the first time I worked with him. Then I worked with him again on a Superman commercial for Max Factor. And I was playing Superman, and I was sort of carrying Lois Lane in my arms, you know, through the air.
Yeah.
And you know, and then of course, you know, that was basically the only two times that I worked Ridley.
And what was he like to work with? I mean, what was he?
He was nice, very pleasant. I enjoyed working with him. I'd love to work with him again. You know. It's,
yeah.
So I would dearly have loved to work with him on Robin Hood, and I'd love to have done something on that one. But my problem is I'm not walking very well at the moment with a guy. I've got a hip problem. So, funny enough, my agent just called me about 10 minutes ago, and he said we're getting loads of offers of work for you, but as soon as they know you're not walking properly, you know, they can't use you. So
you also got the part in the Stanley Kubrick's 1971 Clockwork Orange as Julian.
Well, now you're going way back now, because that was 1970.
That's right, 1970. What was Kubrick like to work with?
Oh, he was lovely. I enjoyed him very much. The thing with Kubrick is everybody was frightened to death of him, and I went to see him to start with, and I had terrible problems with the appointments. I kept on cancelling not turning up to the appointments I made. And eventually they turned around and said, well, look, Stanley definitely wants to see you. Can you make an appointment at your convenience? I thought, well, the only time he's definitely going to be there, it would say 8 o'clock on a Sunday night.
Yeah.
So I went to his house. It was 8 o'clock on a Sunday night, and he was there waiting for me. And he said, well, look, you know, this is the part I want you to do. Just read this line. And it was only one line. And he said, well, of course, I can tell you're not acting. I said, well, how do you act with one line, like, you know?
Yeah.
But he was really nice, and I got on fabulously well with him. And we finished up the film, The Best of Friends, and with an open invite to go to his house. And he said, look, if ever you're up in Elstree and you're passing by and want to come in for a cup of tea, you know, you're more than welcome. And it was quite strange, actually, because just recently, earlier this year, we had a big exhibition at the Movium in London.
Okay.
And a lady comes up to me. She said, you don't recognize me, do you? And I said, no. I said, who are you? She said, I'm Stanley Kubrick's daughter. And I said, well, hang on a minute. I said, I haven't seen you since 1970. And I said, we're talking about nearly 40 years ago.
Yes.
I would have seen you. She said, well, I used to come to the house to watch you filming. And she said, I used to think you were sort of, you know, so this big giant of a man, because he was only a kid at the time.
That's incredible.
He was lovely. I liked him very much.
Of course. And do you still keep in contact with the daughter now?
She gave me her business card and things like that, you know. But I've not been in touch with her since.
And is it true that Stanley would take so many takes to shoot just one scene?
Oh yeah. I mean, before the film started, but before I got involved, I thought myself, I must go and see him work. And so I heard he was filming at Harlow Hospital.
Okay.
And Alex was being interviewed by the psychiatrist. And after he jumped out, out the window.
And that's Malcolm McDowell you're talking about there.
Yeah, Malcolm McDowell. Yeah. So I got to the hospital about 11 o'clock in the morning, and he was already on takes 30 something, like, you know. I mean, normally speaking, I mean, nowadays, when you do a film, it's like, you know, do one, two, three takes at the most, like, you know, you probably do one, if the first one's right, you always take another one just for an insurance purpose, like, you know.
Yeah.
And you only do a couple of takes, four or five at the absolute maximum, like, you know. But Stanley was already on take 30-something when I got there at 11 o'clock in the morning, and he finished at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on take 70-something, like, you know.
Wow.
Absolutely ridiculous, Because everybody comes out and says, "Well, what a genius Stanley Kubrick was," and I said, "Well, you know, if you're in Stanley Kubrick's position, admittedly, as I said, you know, he has what I call the eye of the director. He can see everything that he wants to see, and he knows exactly what he wants to do.
Yes.
But number one, he's got a choice of doing anything he wants, because I mean, all the film companies were falling over backwards to offer him work." So as I said, he's got the choice of doing anything that he wants to do, he can do. And secondly, he's got unlimited amount of money. Thirdly, he's got unlimited. He can. Every actor in the world is clamoring to work for him, you know. And three, four, he's got an unlimited amount of time. And as I said, and number five, he employs the very best technicians. So I mean, you can't very go. I mean, as I said, apart from having this fantastic eye for the scene and everything else.
Sure. Sure.
It's no wonder that he comes up with such good films.
And what did you feel about being in a film that was banned for some 27 years? Because obviously it was withdrawn.
It didn't affect me in the slightest. No. I was just very, very sorry people didn't see it until he died. Yeah. I mean, it was controversial to a certain extent, but there was a sort of a, you know, a sexual content to it, and of course there was some relatively a fair amount of what I call mindless violence, but I don't think it over-glorified either of it, so it's, I don't really see why it should have been banned. The only problem was that Stanley, I think, started getting death threats, and it was causing so much controversy that he just decided to take it off the circuit, and that was it. I mean, the day after he died, the film was released. They couldn't wait to get it back on the scene.
No, that's right. It came out in a 2000 re-release.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, you've trained Christopher Reeves for the Superman movie.
That's right, yeah.
Would you just tell us briefly a little bit about that and how that came about as well?
Well, I tried very hard to get the part for myself, but they wouldn't entertain me because I was... they said, you're perfect, you're everything that we're looking for, but you're not American. Superman is such a major part of American comic folklore history that the American public, who are going to amount for the biggest revenue of the film, we just wouldn't accept anything but an American as Superman. So I really didn't stand a chance, although I tried very, very hard. I mean, I really didn't stand a chance. And, I mean, I eventually finished up meeting up with Dick Donner, and he said, well, you know, you're everything what they were looking for, but, you know, we can't play you. Then eventually I get a call from him, and he says... we've got this guy called Christopher Reeves. Would you like to come and meet him? Because we're very much like you to train him. So I said, well, what's he like? They said, well, he's 6'5" and he weighs about 12 stone. And I said, well, he's positively skinny. And they said, well, that's the problem. You know, do you think you could build him up for us? And I said, well, how long have I got? And they said, well, 6 weeks. And I said, well, I can't do very much in 6 weeks. You know, it's not long enough.
Yeah.
But in fact, we worked very, very hard together. And he was lovely. He was wonderful to work with. And I put 40 pounds on him in 6 weeks. Took him from 12 and a half stone up to 15. I think it was 15 stone one or 15 stone two when he went into a Superman suit. Still nowhere near big enough.
So, okay, now how old were you, would you say, roughly, when you got the hire to do the Star Wars film?
Well, I was 40. Exactly 40, going in for 41.
So that's pretty much proof that life can start at 40 then, can't it, for career-wise?
Yeah, yeah. I got that in the Green Cross Code at exactly the same time. So sort of life certainly began at 40.
So, David, what was George Lucas like as a director?
Well, very quiet. Richie had nothing to do with him whatsoever. I mean, hardly ever spoke to anybody. And least of all, me. I mean, if everything was going okay, you know, he wouldn't interfere. And if anything was going wrong, or if you were doing something that he didn't like, he would say so. But, I mean... it just seems as though everything that I was doing was okay, and we got very little in the way of conversation from him. And in fact, I've not spoken to him since 1982, I think it was. Yeah, last I spoke to him.
Right, and so I'd say then he was probably quite a reserved person.
Yeah, very, very, well, very, not, I don't say it's a reserved, but just very, very quiet.
Very quiet.
Obviously, he works very closely with all his technicians and things like that. But I don't think he had a very, very good rapport. Not with the general. Well, not with what I call the lesser actors. Obviously,
yeah.
He worked very closely with Sir Alec Guinness, Harrison, Mark, and Carrie. You know, the four of them were sort of quite close to him. But I don't think he had any rapport with the rest of us.
Maybe I should change that word from reserve to saying maybe shy was the word I'm looking for.
No, I don't think he was shy. No, I think he was just so totally engrossed in what he was doing.
Okay, fair enough. And why did you choose to play the character Darth Vader then, David?
Well, I was offered Chewbacca first, and I didn't fancy playing a hairy gorilla. And I was trying to get away from doing masked roles at the time, because I'd done a whole series of Frankensteins and creatures and things like this, and I wanted people to see my face occasionally. As I said, they offered me Chewbacca, and I said no, I didn't fancy that, because he said it was like a hairy gorilla that went through the film on the side of the goodies. And I said, well, no, I don't fancy that, George. I said, what's the other part? And he said, well, the other part is the big villain of the film, a character called Darth Vader. And I said, thank you very much. I'll have the villain's part, thank you very much. And he said, well, tell me for why. And I said, well, you think back on all the films that you've seen where there are goodies and baddies. I said, you always remember the baddie. You always remember the bad guy. I said, you've only got to think back on all the James Bond movies. And I said, you remember people like Oddjob and Goldfinger and Blofeld and Scaramanga and Jaws and all these terrible villains. Yeah. I said, but you tell me who played James Bond in the movie. And he said, Davies, I think you made a very wise decision. He said, because nobody will ever forget Darth Vader. And here we are, 30 years later, travelling around the world on the back of Darth.
Having this conversation now, it's incredible. I mean, do you have any idea how big Star Wars was going to be or how massive it was going to be?
No idea whatsoever. No idea.
Oh. Yeah. And I understand, well, from what I've heard, it was quite hellish inside the Darth Vader suit while filming.
Well, very hot. Very hot, because it went on in 15 different pieces. And it was all made from quilted leather and fiberglass, and it weighed about 40 pounds. But you used to keep most of it off as long as you possibly could. And then you'd rehearse without the thing, without the cape and the mask and the helmet and things like that. And then you would eventually do a final rehearsal and a take, wearing everything. And that was the biggest problem was the heat used to rise up inside the suit and go up inside the mask.
Yeah.
And mist up the eyepieces.
Well, what was it like for the stormtroopers then and the Chewbacca?
Exactly the same. I think they were even more uncomfortable than I was. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Because they couldn't sit down and they couldn't kneel down properly and things like this. They were this, and all the plastic used to cut into the skin. They weren't very comfortable suits.
No. And what was the idea to start off with Episode 4? Was there a theme book?
Well, I think George had written the whole series in 9 episodes, and when he was given the opportunity to make a film from Loop by 20th Century Fox, they looked at the 9 and said, well, the only one that stands up on its own is number 4. It's got a beginning, a middle, and an end. And so they went away and did 4, and then, of course, 4 was a huge success, so they did the sequel to 4, which was Empire Strikes Back. And that, too, was a big success, and they then finished the middle trilogy with Return of the Jedi. And then, unfortunately, they then waited 20 years and then went back and did 1, 2, 3, whereas personally, I would have thought with the success it was achieving, I still think they should have gone on and done 7, 8, 9 rather than 1, 2, 3, and also not wait 20 years.
Well, I suppose that they've always got the option to do the 7, 8, and 9.
Yeah. But, you know, I don't know. It would have been nice to have come to 7, 8, 9 and go with the people as the main stars as they were getting older themselves.
Yeah, of course. Well, what was it like to work with some of the bigger stars on Episode 4, like, for example, Peter Cushing and Sir Alec Guinness?
Well, he was lovely. Yeah, I worked with Peter Cushing several times, and he was a really lovely, lovely man. I liked him very much. Alec Guinness was very reserved. I used to sit down and have a chat with him every so often, and we used to go and practice the sword fight and things like this, you know. But not over what I call overly friendly,
Yeah.
But he was approachable, you know. And as I found, one of the interesting things, years later, somebody wrote a biography of him, and it was a huge, great, thick tome. This book is, and I thought, I wonder if I got a mention in it, and so I looked up the index on this book, and it said page 475 or whatever it was. Dave Prowse, and it's just got one mention, so I turned up page 475, and when I got the role, one of the first things that happened was I got invited to go to Elstree Studios to have lunch with Sir Alec Guinness. So it was George Lucas, myself, and Gary Kurtz, the producer, and Sir Alec Guinness, and we had this very, very nice lunch, and then went over to the studios to meet up with the stunt arranger, so that was the first time I met him. And in his book, he says, the only mention I have in the book, he says, had lunch today with Dave Prowse, the gentleman who is going to play Darth Vader. I fear he is not an actor.
How well he didn't know you, hey?
And I look at it now, and I think, well, who is it everybody remembers from Star Wars?
Exactly.
It's always Darth Vader, remember Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Well, what did you think when you first saw the lightsabers on screen with all the special effects added?
We only fought with sticks. On the screen, I thought it was tremendous. On the first movie, I think everything was hand painted in on the negative, whereas it was all CG'd in the second and third. I also had a stuntman, so I did all the sword duel in the first with Sir Alec, and then I did part of it in the second with Mark, and then eventually they decided it would be much better if they had a professional swordsman, as it were.
Sure.
And they got the British fencing coach in to come and be my stunt double, which I was thrilled to bits about because I wasn't very happy doing doing the stunt work, the sword fighting. I thought, obviously you can get somebody much better at it than me. And that's what they did.
So, the character R2-D2. We've just had Kenny Baker on the show before yourself. What was he like to work with?
Very nice. You know, I still see him now. I mean, we still work together. We do all the conventions together. He's not really, he's not a well man at the moment, but he's just had a bit of a health scare, and they're not allowing him to fly. So,
yeah.
And then, R2, Kenny Baker I see regularly. Boba Fett I see regularly. And all the sort of lesser characters I see. You see Mark Hamill occasionally at the big conventions. Carrie Fisher does quite a few conventions in America. You never see Harrison Ford. And that's basically it. I mean,
yeah,
it's...
And what was C-3PO like to work with, Anthony Daniels?
I never had anything to do with him.
No.
I never had anything to do with him at all. He was never in any of my scenes.
And what was Harrison Ford like to work with?
He was nice, very pleasant. I used to when Billy Dee Williams came along, you know, they bought themselves some weights and they wanted to train together. So I used to give them a bit of instruction as to what to do and what not to do. And they were quite pleasant.
Yeah. And obviously with Star Wars, with it, the technology was so new. You must have worked on blue screen technology for the first time, and it was new in the industry, I believe, back then in 1976.
Yes, it was, but I can't remember whether I did any blue screen stuff. I can't remember. I must have done, but I can't remember much about it.
Now, regarding the Darth Vader voice, which is probably a question you get quite a bit, was you ever consulted that it was going to be overdubbed?
No. I think it was fairly obvious that they were going to have to do something because everything I had to learn all the dialogue and deliver the dialogue through all three movies.
Yeah.
But of course, everything that I was saying was muffled because it was coming through the mask, you see. And then at the end of Star Wars, they all chased back to America to get more special effects and so on and so forth. And Lucas had said to me during the filming that we were going to go into the sound studios, and re-record all my dialogue. And anyway, they chased back to America without me going into the sound studios. And of course, then I think while they were in America, they had a choice. It was probably a financial situation whereby it was a choice of either flying me out from London to Hollywood,
yeah,
and then get me over to Hollywood and doing the voiceover, and it not being right, or alternatively finding the very very best voiceover man in the world, which is James Earl Jones, at the time, and paying him the sort of fee that he wanted, and knowing that they were going to get it right the first time. So I think that was the decision, really.
But I hear that you do a very good Darth Vader voice, so I'm sure you could have done it.
I'm a bass baritone, so I mean, I have a fairly sort of deep voice. But of course, I have what they call a West Country accent. You see, so
okay.
I don't think I think they thought my R's and R's were too strong.
Okay. So what was the feeling then when you first watched the original Star Wars movie in the August
amazement.
Of 77? Yeah.
Amazement.
I mean, what was the cinema's reaction? Was it
amazement? Well, everybody stood up and applauded. Everybody stood up and applauded as soon as the first scenes had finished. When the spaceship we had a showing for the cast and crew and all the press, and the spaceship just came in from behind you into the cinema screen. And everybody was absolutely amazed. They all stood up and applauded, and it was an amazing scene.
And what would you say your sort of favourite Star Wars movie is?
I still like Empire. I like Star Wars. I mean, Star Wars had a fantastic feel to it, but I think Empire Strikes Back was like the adult version of Star Wars, as it were. And I enjoyed working with Irvin Kershner, the director.
Yeah,
he was nice.
That's another question I was going to come to today, which is why did George not direct The Empire or Jedi?
Know. No idea.
Because it was only the first Star Wars originally that he directed.
Yeah, he did the first one, yeah.
And did you ever get to sit in a TIE fighter or see the Millennium Falcon then? Or?
Oh, yeah, we had a full-size Millennium Falcon. In fact, I have a piece of the Millennium Falcon in my archive. Yeah.
Right.
Which is worth a lot of money, obviously.
Yeah. And was it hard work when filming these films, David?
Yeah, very hard.
So it wasn't much
everybody
fun.
Thinks it was a big fun, easy job, but it wasn't. It was pretty hard work, to be honest, yeah.
Do you feel, though, that you were denied the publicity and public appearance of the Star Wars trilogy? And was that, would you say, due to Darth Vader becoming the cult figure of the series?
No, I had my fair amount of publicity from the movie on, but I think very quickly when Star Wars first came out, I was asked if I would do personal appearances as Darth Vader, and I did a couple, a couple of really nice ones, and I think very quickly they realised it was much cheaper to dress any big guy up in a black suit and parade him around as Darth Vader and fob him off as me.
Yeah.
And this is basically what happened, which annoyed me intensely, because all these Darth Vaders appeared all over the world, and everybody says, it's like even now to this day, I go to conventions and people will come up to me and they say, oh, do you remember meeting me? And I said, well, when? They said, oh, it was in a shopping mall in Milwaukee. I said, I've never been to Milwaukee. They said, oh yes, it was you, definitely, because I got your photograph and you signed a photograph for me. And I said, was it signed by Dave Prowse? And he said, well, no, it was just Darth Vader. And I said, well, thank you very much. It wasn't me. Definitely wasn't me.
Mm.
And so, and that annoyed me intensely, because I said, because I obviously lost a big earning possibility by them doing what they did. But as I said, what annoyed me more was the fact that they were fobbing the public off with all these dress-up characters and telling them all that it was me.
No, then indeed,
because the Darth Vaders they had weren't allowed to speak.
Do you think those problems stem from the problems on the set of Jedi? Because there was a sort of ostracization, wasn't there, on that set with a few.
Well, I got accused of something I didn't do, this started with Star Wars. Everything started with Star Wars when they started dressing all these people up. The problem on Jedi was that I got accused of giving information away to the press, and I don't know how they could ever thought I could have given them information away to the press, because I've never ever seen a copy of the script from that day to this.
That's right.
Still not seen a copy of the script. All we used to get were our pages, and I had only just started work on the movie when everything happened, and it was just some idiot reporter from the Daily Mail who obviously had information, who was privy to information. Somebody was obviously selling information to the press, and he told me that I was going to be killed off in the movie, and then unfortunately. Put it in the paper the following day as an exclusive interview with Dave Prowse, and it looked as though I'd given him the information, which of course I hadn't. But Lucasfilm has never ever forgiven me or ever sort of apologized for their treatment of me.
Well, it's like you say. How could you have leaked the information when you didn't even have the script?
Yeah, exactly.
So it must have come from someone else in the production.
Yeah, yeah.
That's right.
How
did you feel when you learnt your character was being killed off?
Well, it wasn't the fact that they were killing—they were killing me off, but they were doing it all in secret, so I wouldn't know.
Right.
They were also so very, very devious about the whole thing. They brought in another actor called Sebastian Shaw, who I wasn't allowed to meet, so I wouldn't know what he was actually doing on the set. And then they were filming in a studio miles away from where I was working. I'd be like working in, say, Studio 1, and he'd be working in Studio 10. Which is miles on the away from me on the lot.
Yeah.
So as I said, it was a question of
very much clever.
Them being very, very underhanded.
Underhand,
on everything that they did.
Yeah, totally.
And I didn't appreciate that at all.
Well, what did you think about the Ewok side of the Jedi?
I think they were fine for the kids, but I think they were the premise of the Ewoks being able to defeat the might of the Empire was stupid, absolutely stupid idea.
Now, David, due to playing Darth Vader, you've travelled around the world again and again. Mm. And what have the conventions been like?
Well, most of them are great. I thoroughly enjoy going to all these different conventions and meeting the fans. You get terrific feedback everywhere you go, and everybody's thrilled to see you. I'm now Commander in Chief of the 501 Squadron, which is all these dress up characters throughout the world. And so I get escorts, wherever I appear at these conventions. It's nice.
That's really cool.
I love it. The only thing I don't like is I'm getting a bit sick and tired of the long-haul flights, going to and fro. I went to Mexico just recently, and that was like 13 hours on the plane getting there and 13 hours getting back. And then I did Orlando this week, and that was 7 or 8 hours on the plane. And
They're long flights,
those,
aren't they?
Those sort of things can, you know, well, it's weigh, a lot, weigh it's, you down a little bit.
Well, that's right.
I'm happier at the moment doing shows, you know, on the continent in England, and in England more so than going to and from America and Japan and Australia.
And what charities do you do work for right now, currently?
Well, my major charity at the present moment is I'm working on behalf of the Royal Marsden Hospital, the cancer hospital, because I was diagnosed with prostate cancer at the beginning of the year and I've got over it. And so I'm trying to raise funds for the Prostate Cancer Association and the Royal Marsden Hospital. I'm also vice president of a FAB organization, which is the Physically Handicapped and Able-Bodied Association. I'm also working with a charity called Walk Once More, which is a spinal injury charity. And through them, I've been asked if I'll get associated with the Reeve Irvine Institute for Stem Cell Research in America, which is obviously to do with Christopher Reeve. There's all sorts. I'm also patron of the Wheelchair Users Association. You get involved in all sorts of different things. I help with the Royal Army Benevolent Fund. You lend your name to all sorts of different charities and help wherever you possibly can.
What we'll do is we're going to dedicate a page to you on the website, so we'll put those links.
Lovely.
On that website, so people
the main,
can come.
The main two charities. Well, I mean, all the charities that I mentioned are obviously very, very worthwhile causes. So the more publicity you can give them, the better.
Sure. Now, David, just briefly, tell me about your relationship with Arnold Schwarzenegger and how that started.
Well, he was a Mr. Universe contestant years ago, and I met up with him when he was 18, actually, and then he came over and he came over to England and he stayed with a gym owner in East London, a guy called Wag Bennett, and his wife Diane, and they taught him English and basically trained him over here, and then of course he eventually. It became the greatest physique in the world, you know, and then when it obviously went to America, and everything has snowballed then. But when he was like in his early days as Mr. Universe, he was like Mr. Universe, and I was the British heavyweight weightlifting champion at the time, and we used to do shows together. He would go to these physical culture shows and do all the muscle stuff, and I would do all the heavy weightlifting, and so we were on the same bill, as it were.
Sure.
And then, of course, over the years, you know, I've always kept in touch. And then last year, well, a couple of years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, he did a reference for me for a work permit for America. and hopefully he's just in the process of doing another one for me at the present moment. So you
keep in contact, yeah.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah. But through, primarily through his association with Wag and Diane Bennett, who were the sort of mentors over here.
Okay. Now, your book, Straight from the Force's Mouth, that's still... I was going to say, you can still currently get second-hand copies of Amazon, but would it ever be republished, do you think?
Yes, we're coming out with a whole new edition. It's been edited at the present moment. I've written another book, which is a more in-depth autobiography bit. Or at least go at this. The editors write to me every so often, and they say, "Well, can you tell us a little bit more about this? And why did this happen? And how did that happen? And where did you go after that? And so on and so forth." You know, and so now I'm trying to fill in all the breaks that there were in the first one. I'm making the second one, or the new one, which we're working on. It's going to be a much better and a more informative book.
Okay, all right. Well, we'll get you back on for open lines to promote that book, definitely. And just one question that's popped in my head there, really. Did your bodybuilding career, would you say it affected your current health?
Well, I think all I'd say for now is I'm reaping the rewards of 50 years of abuse. Because I mean, when you're lifting all these heavy weights, you know, obviously your body takes its toll, as it were. And I think I was very lucky because I had very few injuries. In fact, I can only think of one major injury that I ever had, and that was to my hip. And unfortunately, once I had the injury to my hip, things just seemed to go wrong from then on because I had the my right hip went to start with, and then I had problems with my left hip, and then I had problems with my ankle. It was like arthritis set in, and then sort of moved around my body, as it were. But that's the only problem I have.
And what advice would you give to people wanting to get into acting that can't seem to make their break right
now?
Oh,
well, it's very, very much a hit and miss thing. It's you really can't give anybody any advice, you know, if you're interested. I always tell people the best thing to do is get plenty of what I call amateur dramatics. Get yourself into a music review company or an amateur dramatic club and things like this, and get as much experience as you can doing plays and musicals and all sorts of things. Okay? And become as rounded a performer as you possibly can. And then once you have the confidence of doing all that, then start pushing yourself towards the professional side. Get yourself hawk yourself around to the agencies, get some really good photographs taken.
Yeah.
Try and get as much experience as you possibly can.
Okay. And what websites can people find you on?
Well, yeah, the best one is, the only one they can find me on is www.darthvader-starwars.com.
Right.
That's the only one I have.
We'll put a link from that on the site as well.
Yeah, please, if you would. Yeah, that'd be nice. And they can, I sell photographs and things like that from the website. And I've got the Straight from the Force's Mouth on MP3 player as well.
Right.
On MP3. So they can buy that and listen to it merrily away.
So you can still get the MP3 disc. Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we'll put a link on there as well for that. Well, look.
Yeah.
David, I want to just thank you so much for coming on today. And,
that was very nice talking to you.
It's an honour to have you on the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
To find out more information on my guest, David Prowse, go to darthvader-starwars.com, or you can buy his book from Amazon, which is Straight from the Force's Mouth, or remember that he's available on my website, themoreshow.co.uk, and if you look up David or Kenny Baker under past guests, you'll find their links, their books, their websites are all available there. Well, until next time, from my guest and myself, be safe.